This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Iraq has captured most of the headlines over the past several months, but we're going to take a look now at the first country to be targeted in the U.S.'s war on terrorism, Afghanistan. The Asian Financial Times reports that at least 22 people have been killed in an attack on a police station in eastern Afghanistan, underscoring growing concerns over the country's fragile stability. In another attack, up to four Afghan government policemen were taken hostage. According to the Christian Science Monitor, more than 90 people have been killed in the past 10 days, making this the bloodiest period in Afghanistan since Operation Anaconda in March 2002. Amnesty International's latest report over the weekend said Afghanistan is still on the critical list, and its recovery is being hampered by the failure of the international community to provide long-term political and financial support to the justice sector. Reestablishing respect for the rule of law is an essential prerequisite for peace and security. The U.S.-installed government of Hamid Karzai is still experiencing extreme fragility in the face of U.S.-sponsored and empowered warlords who control many parts of Afghanistan outside Kabul. Mark Harold, professor at the University of New Hampshire, spoke with Sonali Kolhatkar of Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles to understand who is responsible for attacks on U.S. forces.
The resistance, of course, in Afghanistan began really very early on last year, and that was presumably coming mostly from the disbanded or fleeing and slowly reconstituting Taliban plus. I say plus, and I'm not quite sure, you know, who the plus is. Undoubtedly, there are some elements of Al-Qaeda as well as Gulbuddin Hekmatyar's group and probably some others. So, you know, there has been this sort of ongoing low-level guerrilla war, which really began last year and never got reported here. This has picked up enormously in the last 2 months or so. The Taliban plus now de facto control an entire province in southeastern Afghanistan, the province of Zabul. They are very, very active in some of the other border provinces, from Helmand to Kandahar to Paktika to Paktia to Nangarhar. They, in effect, control the province of Kunar and the province of Nuristan. So the entire sort of southern, eastern part of Afghanistan is really very much up for grabs. Some time ago, about 2 or 3 weeks ago, the Taliban announced that they were sending some of their military leaders. They actually named the people up to the northern provinces to start the fighting there, too. As you, in your newscast, mentioned, just over this weekend, there's been a lot of fighting. There was a district office, which was taken over in Paktika, in the town of Turwa. Three Afghan soldiers were killed, four were kidnapped. And what's actually interesting about these attacks, particularly the one which happened yesterday, another one yesterday, was that 300 Taliban plus drove 15 to 18 kilometers across the border into Afghanistan in a convoy of trucks at night, took over a administrative headquarters in the town of Barmal, which is a fairly, you know, significant town in Paktika, and held it for 5 hours. And this is part of the tactic. The tactic is to hold districts, to hold towns temporarily, to increase the perception and the reality that Afghanistan is not governable.
Mark Harold, on the issue of food, water, and electricity and other necessities that Afghans have been denied for so long, did the so-called U.S. liberation bring any significant improvement?
Well, there's been marginal improvement in some urban areas, particularly in Kabul. But the real improvement has come about not from anything Mr. Karzai or the United States did, and that's a change in the weather. After 2 to 3 years of terrible drought, Afghanistan was blessed with rain in the last 6 months or so, and this has really improved the situation with regards to food. So the food situation is good, I would say, in Afghanistan. What is not good is just about everything else. And, you know, Mr. Karzai remains de facto really the mayor of Kabul. Outside Kabul, the scope of the central government is basically non-existent. There is an absence of tangible reconstruction effects in the countryside. Most aid has been going to humanitarian purposes. And let me just say something about aid here, because we often hear that so little aid, in fact, has gone into Afghanistan. In fact, in a relative sense, a lot of aid has flowed into Afghanistan. Afghanistan's GDP, gross domestic product, is about $4.4 billion in 2002. In 2002, about $1.8 billion of aid flowed in. So over 40%, this is an amount which is about 40% of Afghanistan's GDP. Let's put this in U.S. terms. The U.S. GDP is $10 trillion. So this would be the equivalent of $4.2 trillion inflows of funds. This would greatly help Mr. Bush's budget problems and the like. So, you know, the aid which has flown in is actually really quite substantial. The other things one can point to is, in terms of, you know, sort of what's been going on, is this year's heroin opium crop is either the highest ever or the second highest. So poppy growing is rampant, and this is simply driven by poverty and necessity. This is a way of getting an income. The countryside is basically up for grabs. There are attacks on the provisional reconstruction teams. There are attacks on aid agencies and so on and so forth. So I think the situation is a very, very difficult situation.
Certainly, it's been documented the Karzai government has been installed by the United States, and you mentioned that he is no more than a mayor of Kabul. But at the same time, the United States has empowered warlords who have been challenging Karzai's power outside of Kabul. Can you talk a little bit about the situation of, you know, or the status of democracy in Afghanistan right now?
Well, the whole idea of a central government elected democratically in Afghanistan is something which is really terribly problematical. I don't think that will happen. Afghanistan during the 20th century was a monarchy. Subsequently, for a few years, it was a republic of sorts, but with a very strong figure at the center. The prospects of democracy, as you know, the West uses that term, I think are very dim. The Amnesty International just came out with a report. Other organizations have as well, indicating the really rather dreadful human rights situation. As you mentioned, Sonali, there are regional, there are local interests, warlords, powerful persons who exert control in their area. And, you know, just this last weekend, Mr. Karzai did a little bit of reshuffling of personalities. It really didn't change much. Somebody was moved from one position to another and a replacement was sent in. I don't think that's really going to do much. And if you take that reality and the ongoing and escalating, and I think it is going to escalating guerrilla war in Afghanistan, the idea that somehow there could be a national reconciliation, a national effort to create a democratic government is a joke. That is not going to happen. Just last Thursday and Friday, 115 people died in Afghanistan. This is in 2 days, under various circumstances and the rest. But it's an indication, I think, of the continued turmoil and intense turmoil leading to death and injury and the like. So I think the prospects are very, very dim for any kind of of, you know, Western-style democratic government. What we have is we have a seemingly Western-style mayoralty in Kabul.
There was much talk before the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan on pipelines. Can you talk about the status of that?
Well, the pipeline deal, the only way the pipeline deal can come across is if there's a government in power which can guarantee stability. And it turns out that over the last decade, the only government which could do that was the Taliban. Currently, there's just no way on earth that a pipeline is going to be built through Herat and Helmand and Kandahar. It's simply much too dangerous. There's a lot of talk about foreign investment flowing into Afghanistan. In fact, very, very little foreign investment has flown into Afghanistan, about $100 million. But most of this is invested in businesses where you have very little asset exposure. So the prospects of large amounts of investment really flowing into Afghanistan, I think, are very, very dim. And certainly a pipeline is just absolutely out of the question, as is the development of the Logar copper deposits. This is not going to be done by private investors who want to have contracts guaranteed and who want an acceptable risk-adjusted rate of return.
Mark Harold, a professor at the University of New Hampshire and author of Blown Away, Myth and Reality of American Precision Bombing. He spoke with Sonali Kolhatkar of Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles. Months after George W. Bush's May declaration of the end to major combat in Iraq, U.S. casualties continue to mount at an alarming pace. At least two more U.S. servicemen were killed in the last 24 hours, bringing the total U.S. military death toll to 194 since the start of the war in March. And as troops continue to die in what military analysts predict will be a long and drawn-out guerrilla war, family members of U.S. troops are increasingly vocal about bringing their loved ones back home. In solidarity with these efforts, former Georgia Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney spoke earlier this week at the House of the Lord Church in Brooklyn, New York. She joined with family members of U.S. servicemen and women, labor leaders, and progressive politicians to call for an end to the U.S. occupation of Iraq. Peace Watch correspondent Jackson Allers reports from New York.
Somebody say, bring the troops home.
Bring the troops home.
This is a memorial piece for all those who we have lost and all those who we will lose. Everybody raise your hands like this.
The atmosphere at the House of the Lord Church in Borum Hill, Brooklyn was electric as a broad coalition of people gathered to call for an immediate return of U.S. troops currently occupying Iraq. The event, billed as a kickoff for a national Bring the Troops Home Now campaign, also helped to make visible the increasing number of family members of U.S. troops speaking out against a continued military involvement in Iraq. Larry Holmes was among the speakers at the event. Holmes, a spokesperson for ANSWER, Act Now to Stop War and End Racism, says the Pentagon and the Bush administration misled the U.S. troops into thinking it would be a quick military engagement.
Told that they were going to help to liberate. And they find out that they're going to colonize and to brutalize and to murder and to occupy. And it's in their own words. They write the letters and the emails home. We've been lied to. And they told they were coming home right away. Find out they're staying there 6 months or longer. They were told they would not be shot at. Yet they're dying every day. And more are being made. The government is keeping those statistics a secret.
And as casualties mount, GI support groups like SNAFU, the Support Network for an Armed Forces Union, are fielding an increasing amount of questions from U.S. troops serving in Iraq on ways to obtain discharges and how to organize anti-war activities on their bases or ships. New York civil rights attorney Ron Kuby also spoke at the event. Kuby and others emphasized that dissent within the military often comes at a high price.
When the troops speak up, saying, in essence, if I may be profane, get us the hell out of here. The military's response is to say, if you speak out against this war, you will be court-martialed. And when the families speak up against the war because they want their sons and daughters back, the military sends out circulars saying, don't speak in public, because to do that will embolden the Saddam Fedayeen. So suddenly, in America, the family members of the troops if they give voice to their concerns about their loved ones, become aiders and abettors and supporters of the enemy. As one general put it some time ago with no sense of irony, we are here to protect democracy, not to practice it.
One serviceman, Stephen Funk, is currently awaiting a court-martial for speaking out against the war. Funk is in a Louisiana military detention facility for conscientious objectors.
What my son did that especially angered the military was that he went public with who he is and what he believes. It's sad and hypocritical that a military which professes to protect the constitutional rights of Americans would punish my son for simply practicing his First Amendment rights.
Gloria Passos is Stephen Funk's mother. Funk told his mother that he had seen at least 50 other conscientious objectors released from detention in the time he had been detained, many of whom he says were released on the condition of being silent about their CO status. Passos says she is surprised President Bush has avoided punishment for his use of the First Amendment.
It is also sad and hypocritical that our quote-unquote president was AWOL for nearly 1 year from his National Guard drills exercises in Alabama. Yet somehow he got elected to the highest office in the land. And uses his First Amendment rights to lie to the American people, to lie to the soldiers still stationed in Iraq, and to lie to the rest of the world.
Former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney of Georgia was the featured speaker of the night. McKinney questioned how powerful Washington insiders like Bush, Cheney, Powell, and Rice are allowed to send the poor and people of color to their deaths for what she calls the cannon fodder for Bush's new American century.
Casper Weinberger suggests that America's people of color are more patriotic than America's young white kids are. And that's why the military is disproportionately more people of color in our all-volunteer military. It is utterly despicable to make that suggestion in the face of a recession-driven economy that has produced the highest unemployment in a generation and pushed more people of color below the middle class.
Moonam, the father of a U.S. serviceman and a co-leader of the United American Indians of New England, also spoke at the event. His son is one of the many troops who will be in Iraq for at least a year. This, as Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld recently announced that U.S. troops will be the occupying force in Iraq for the next 12 months. Moonam told the crowd Native Americans are all too familiar with U.S. occupation tactics.
People of color in the U.S. know firsthand what it is like to be on the receiving end of a campaign of war and terror. Native people have dealt for centuries with the terrorism of the U.S., Canadian, Mexican, and other colonizing governments. I urge all of you here tonight to consider the knowledge that we have gained during that time. If we had unified early on, worked together, rather than as separate nations, we may have prevailed. At this time, we must come together and speak in unity with one voice and say, bring the troops home now.
Another family member on hand at the event was Gloria Jackson. Jackson's daughter is among those who joined the military ranks out of what she perceived was an economic opportunity.
I feel very bad because I suggested that she go in because I couldn't afford to send her to college.
According to Jackson, her daughter is scheduled to come back to the U.S. on September 4th, but recent orders indicate she will have to stay in Iraq until she finds her replacement. Jackson is distraught at the reports her daughter is sending back home.
I want my daughter home, and she supposed to be home on September the 4th, but they keep telling her that she can't come home unless she find a replacement. And I'm saying, no, why can't she come home? You know, I don't see why she should be over there. They say the war is over. I can't say exactly what she said to me, but she says it's not really over. If you could just see what's going on. I can't, you know, if I could just tell you everything that she says to me, I wish I could, but I want her home.
Meanwhile, the family members of U.S. troops are growing increasingly impatient with the U.S. government's occupation stance. At Fort Stewart in Benning, Georgia, home of the 3rd Infantry Division, a group of 800 family members started a near riot when the base colonel could not answer questions about when their loved ones were coming home. The colonel had to be escorted out by the military police. And recent polls indicated growing skepticism about the U.S. troops' presence in Iraq. This as President Bush conceded in July that America had a, quote, security issue in Iraq that required them to, quote, remain tough. For Peace Watch at the House of the Lord Church in New York, I'm Jackson Allers.
Jim Hightower, noted author and political satirist, offers these thoughts on conditions in Iraq as U.S. and civilian casualties continue more than 3 months after Bush declared the end of major combat.
The way out is to get out and to turn this over truly to an international community, the United Nations, not under our thumb, but a truly international and as Muslim as possible operation that works in Iraq. But ultimately, long term, the way out of these quagmires is to have the U.S. With a foreign policy that reflects our values of economic fairness, social justice, equal opportunity for all people. Instead of being on the side of corporate power in these nations, instead of being on the side of the despots, let us get on the side of the people themselves and have the U.S. as a beacon of democracy being our appeal, rather than being the bully of the world. And Bob Herbert has a terrific column this morning in the New York Times where he talks about this as an invasion based on lies and deceits. And now here we are stuck in it with an administration that clearly doesn't have any comprehension at all about the culture or about the history or a recognition that our very presence in that country is a humiliation just to ordinary Muslims and ordinary Iraqis. Yeah, Saddam and his remaining lieutenants are thugs, but we've got a problem way beyond that. And the problem is we are perceived as an occupying government, and that is not anything, that is not a position that is good for us here at home, because it creates even more of that antagonism, deep-seated, passionate antagonism.
That was Jim Hightower, author of Thieves in High Places. Well, the spotty restoration of electrical and water services and the delay in establishing an Iraqi transitional government is fueling anti-American sentiments in Iraq and hostilities against U.S. troops. Paul Bremer, the U.S. administrator in Iraq, said recently that the U.S. will work to solve this problem by privatizing Baghdad's state-owned industries. Scott Harris of the syndicated radio program Between the Lines spoke recently with author and columnist Naomi Klein, who discussed her views of the Bush administration's economic plan for Iraq.
Now, I think what's clear is that by the time Iraqis have some semblance of a democratic process, and who knows when that's going to be, maybe it'll be a year from now, maybe it'll be 2 years from now, whenever it is, it's clear that all of the key economic decisions that are going to affect the ability of that new government to act in meaningful ways, those decisions will all have already have been made, and contracts will be locked in, multi-year contracts. So this is essentially, this is about democracy. I mean, Bush has said that the war wasn't really about weapons of mass destruction. It's actually about freedom and democracy. Well, this whole issue of privatization taking place before there's a democracy is an incredibly flagrant assault on the basic principles of self-determination. And I think we have to be really careful when we say, oh, the Reconstruction has been a crisis or it's been a disaster. Well, it's been a disaster for the Iraqi people, but it hasn't been a disaster for Bechtel. And in fact, what's happened is they have kind of bombed the country into a blank slate where they are rebuilding it in the image that is exactly prescribed by the so-called Washington Consensus of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, where all of the state industries, including oil, are going to be privatized. And at the same time, Paul Bremer, before he even had the lights back on in Baghdad, declared that Iraq was, quote-unquote, open for business, which meant that all of the foreign exports were pouring across the border. And Iraqi companies that had been suffering under 13 years of sanctions and months of lootings and then blackouts because of a lack of electricity, were told that they should, you know, welcome to the free market. Now you can compete with these multinationals. And, of course, they're all closing down. So that's what I mean by a process that, say, in the Soviet Union or Argentina took 5 years is happening in Iraq, you know, in 2 months. But I think it's important, I guess, to look at such a naked exercise of so-called free market economics to see that they were never supposed to compete in the first place. I mean, the idea that they could have competed under these conditions is absolutely absurd. And I think that it really does put the lie to the idea that there is a free market on the global scale.
You have followed quite closely, and in your most recent book, wrote dispatches about the various forms that the movement that opposes corporate-led globalization has taken around the world. What can you tell us about the intersection between those groups opposing corporate-led globalization and the recent, quite astonishing peace movement that took root on almost every continent of the world?
Well, I think that there are lots of connections. I think that they aren't the same movement, but they're inseparable in so many ways. For instance, the coordinated peace demonstrations on February 15th could never have happened without the networks that were created by the globalization movements, from the World Social Forums to indie media, which was really the voice of those demonstrations and allowed people to feel that they were part of something truly global, I think in a really unique and unprecedented way. But I think that the question is, how do we deepen those connections through this period of ongoing wars and also occupation? And that's why I think it really is important to focus on what is actually happening with this so-called reconstruction or privatization disguised as reconstruction in Iraq, because I think that Iraq is not a distraction or a sideline from the debate about the global economy and how it's progressing. I think it's the cutting edge of that debate in the sense that there is a global economic crisis. There is a recession, and there is a growing skepticism and rejection of many of the policies that we've been talking about. In Latin America, for instance, there is huge opposition to the idea of a free trade agreement of the Americas. But there's also been a steady stream of opposition to new privatizations. And what this means is that there's growing desperation from the companies that need growth to survive, which is every company, which is how capitalism works. And because of that, we are seeing this phenomenon that I called, you know, bomb before you buy, which is a flip way of describing what happened in Iraq. But I think we are, frankly and sadly, going to see more of it. So I can't, in my mind, separate the debate about globalization or free trade from an analysis of war, because to me, what we're actually seeing are wars being waged to pave the way for precisely the policies that we in the globalization movement have been opposing steadily for the past 5 years.
Do you see the anti-globalization organizations and the peace groups focusing their attention now on the post-war situation in Iraq and the privatizations and the threat, as you say, that this could be the template, the model for future engagements by the United States and their corporate sponsors?
I think it is starting to happen. But frankly, if we're to be honest, I think we have to admit that we, on the left, are destabilized. And I personally think more than anything else, this is the Bush strategy, which is to behave so quixotically, so unpredictably, basically to act like a crazy person, that basically all of your potential opposition is in a permanent state of destabilization, trying to figure out what the next move is going to be. You know, it's been really difficult to think strategically over the past year and a half, but I think that there's certainly consensus that we need to somehow find our bearings and understand that the fact that we're confused is not a coincidence, that it's a strategy.
Naomi Klein is the author of Fences and Windows, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Globalization Debate and No Logo. She spoke with Scott Harris on the syndicated radio program Between the Lines. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. Our associate producer is Angelique Chauffard. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.